This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal. I'm joining you from our Lexington, Kentucky studio. I would like to thank everyone for joining us this evening. And by the way, I have a very important announcement to make this week. We are now on Sirius 219 XM 206. Don't forget, write it down, Sirius 219. Of course, you can always find us on our website, horseracingradio.net. Another important announcement, I know I say it every week, but if you've enjoyed listening to Jock Talk, please take just 5 minutes to check out a wonderful nonprofit organization, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial support for permanently disabled riders who have given everything to the sport. If you are able to help, please visit the website www.pdjf.org. Now this evening, we are joined by a jockey who found himself in the winner's circle of one of North America's most prestigious races at a very young age. He's traveled all over the world, and he's racked up 1,132 wins and over $39 million in earnings. Jockey Chris DiCarlo. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here, Chris. And I was just thinking, while I was preparing for the show, it's been a very long time since I've seen you, and hope you're doing well. Like I said, the way we typically do these shows, I'd love to find out how you got in the sport. How did the beginning start? What happened? So take us back to the beginning, Chris.
Angel Cordero had been a friend of my family's ever since I've been born. And my grandfather was a singer in Puerto Rico at the time Angel was coming up as a rider. And he was pretty popular on the island, and they became friends. And my grandfather's lifelong dream, or was a lifelong dream, he just had a dream. He always wanted to be a jockey, but he grew. So he was hanging out with Angel one day, and he had mentioned that to Angel, and he says, well, since you got too big, we'll make your grandson a jockey. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I guess I was a year. I don't even know how old I was. But I'm living my dream. That's basically what happened.
Wow. So at a very, very young age, you were destined to be a jockey. And your grandfather was a famous singer. Chris, do you sing?
No, not at all.
No, not at all.
I don't have that gene.
They just had jockey karaoke in Saratoga. I didn't know if you were a part of that.
I was there, but no, I'm not a singer.
No. Well, hey, you know, your grandfather always wanted to be a jockey, and you made that dream come true. So tell me, how old were you when you first started riding?
I was 4 years old when I first started riding horses.
Wow.
And that was basically it. I'd been riding horses ever since. I took, growing up from school, I stopped for a couple of years and bicycles and did all that sort of stuff. But my dream all along was to become a jockey. That was the plan.
So you're...
And that's basically it.
So you were athletic even as a kid and from, a very young age. Now, when you were 4 years old, were you helping out in the barn? Were you riding the pony? What were you doing at such a young age?
No, I took regular lessons.
Okay.
I started on a little pony. And I guess maybe after 3 or 4 months, they started. I started jumping and doing that whole aspect.
Wow.
And I wasn't really too fond of jumping at the time because I guess my helmet was a little big, and every time the horse would jump, my helmet would fall in front of my eyes, and I did it. But then one day, the pony I was on decided to be bad, and the teacher, to get the horse to try to jump or do what it wasn't supposed to do, threw a stick at the horse, and I fell.
Oh, no.
And needless to say, that was the last time I took lessons from that person. So then my parents found another trainer that actually had racehorses, and I learned from him till, I guess, from 4 to about 14 years old.
Wow.
I started galloping on the racetrack when I was 15.
So did he put you on a few of his racehorses?
Yeah, the first actual racehorse that I got on, I was like 6 years old, and they had just brought him in off the track, and he had like a little 3/8 of a mile racetrack, and I got on the horse, and they had the pony with me, and we started off, and the shank broke, and this horse was like barreling down the racetrack, and I was like horrified. I was screaming, crying, and they told me to jump, and I jumped, which was really not a good thing to do.
No.
I didn't get hurt, but like it kind of traumatized me a little bit, and it took me about 3 or 4 weeks before I was able actually to canter a horse and get my confidence back.
I'm surprised that you even got back on after that kind of an experience, Chris. Wow. So at a very, very young age, you found out what it felt like to go very fast.
That was horrifying. Well, it wasn't horrifying. I just wasn't like mentally, I wasn't prepared, you know, because you get on a pony or a regular horse and they're kind of like dead. And then I got on this horse and he was just, you know, race horses are amped up.
Oh, yeah.
And they're big to me even now, and I'm, you know, when I was little and you're fearless, you know, you really don't have any fear. It kind of scared me a little bit.
6 years old, that is definitely understandable. So fast forward a few years, you said at 15 you started galloping at the racetrack. So tell us how that went.
Well, the plan all along was, I have an uncle who's like 6'2", and because I wanted to be a jockey, my parents agreed that, you know, when I hit 16, if I was ready to ride and I was small, that they would let me pursue my dream. In the event that I grew, at least I can, you know, say that I, you know, lived my dream or did what I wanted to do growing up. So when I was about 15, my dad had called Angel, and we'd been speaking all along, you know, on my progress. And he said, well, send him to me, and then he could stay with me for the summer, and we'll see if we can get him on some horses. So I was at Angel's house for about 3 or 4 days, and he was going to different people and asking them, and there was no luck, you know. They said, yeah, he's too small, I used to wear glasses. And I think the last day I was there, he says, oh, we're going to ask Alan Jerkins, if you can, you know, if he'll let you get on some horses. Now, me growing up, I didn't know trainers, jockeys. I was always around, you know, Angel and Georgie and Jacinto Vasquez and all those guys, but I never knew trainers. And the first day I met Alan, he was at Belmont Park. That's a tunnel where they, when to go into the paddock, and I guess he was schooling horses. It was like 10:30 or 11. So Angel tells me to sit by the bench while he goes and talks to this guy. And Alan is a really, really big man. He's like, well, at the time he was really tall because I was maybe 4'8", you know. And Angel goes over there and he's, you know, just complimenting him, saying, hey, Daddy, how you doing? And your horses are running great. He says, you see that little kid over there? He wants to be a jockey. Can he come by and get on horses for you? And he looked at me, and then he looked at Angel, and then he looked back at me and just, like, let out, like, what do you think? I run a riding academy? So now this guy is, like, yelling at him at the top of his lungs. I didn't even know who he is, and I'm like, who that? This guy's crazy. You know, I was, like, horrified. So Angel came back with his tail between his legs, and then he yells back at him. He says, send him to the barn in the morning. So then I went over there, and then the following morning, I wound up tack walking a few that had come back from the track, and then I wound up getting on this horse. It was 2-year-old, and I was on him for about an hour before he asked me if I was going to the track and gallop. And that's basically how it started.
Wow.
You were, the track part, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you were surrounded by good people. My gosh. Staying with Angel Cordero. Now, prior to going to the track with Angel, did he get you on the Equisizer? Were you watching replays? Or what was he trying to teach you at that time?
Well, no. I mean, I had been riding horses all along. I mean, I used to watch the big races. There wasn't any Equisizer. Maybe Frankie Lovato was just inventing the Equisizer at that time. But, it was just pretty much riding lessons, and there wasn't any real preparation. Once I got to Angels, you know, I did watch a lot of videos. But with him, it was more, I learned more by watching than actually doing. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't ask too much questions. I just absorbed everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That definitely makes sense. And what did Alan Jerkins think about you after that day?
Well, the horse, well, he didn't run off, but he kind of almost did. He was a 2-year-old, big. He was like 17 hands high. And then I guess he said something to Angel, and then the next day was better, and then by the third day, everything was normal. I guess I was so nervous. Plus, you know, you don't want to screw up when you're that age.
Exactly. You didn't. No, not
after.
But then
I did. But then I did wind up one of the outriders there. He knew I wasn't young enough because I looked young. So they actually made my age a year older, so I could gallop. And that's how I was able to get a license.
Oh, no.
It's 30 years later, so I guess nobody will get in trouble.
I was going to say, I think you're safe now, Chris.
That's your limitations on getting in trouble for that.
Wow. That's amazing. And what did Alan, did he kind of give you any advice along the way, or did he just, you know, see that you were improving and kind of left it at that?
Yeah, Alan... he it was kind of weird. Like, you know, it was like things were, you learn. He was another person that you learned more from by watching than actually asking questions. I guess I'm that type of person, though, because, like, I'm not really talkative, you know, and but I focus.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I didn't half the time. I was a kid. I didn't want to interrupt them, number one.
Right.
And number two, there's so many people that were working for him that helped me along that really didn't have to ask him too much. He more of like told me, like, if I was walking on a horse, he'd say, well, watch out, the horse doesn't duck from this and do, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'd say nine times out of 10, if he said a horse was going to, it happened.
He was
like,
right.
You could prepare all you want. Watch this horse don't wheel with you at the eighth pole. Sure enough, it would happen.
Well, that's good. At least you got a heads up.
Where I was saying, well, don't be telling me stuff because it happens.
Oh, gosh.
It's almost like he was clairvoyant, you know?
Well, you know, again, at least you had a heads up anyway, you know? At least you were ready, I hope.
Yeah. But well, no, it would still fall off. But, you know, it's like, then you got to, I told you.
Then you're embarrassed. Yeah, that's not good. Jockey Chris DiCarlo joining me on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So how long did you work for Alan?
I galloped for Alan I started in, I guess, August of 84, and I rode my first race in May of 85.
Wow. So when it came when it was getting close and you felt like you were about ready to get started, what did you do as far as did the Angel think you were ready and did you feel like
he was asking Alan, and Alan didn't think I was ready. Or I actually don't know how it happened. I just know that one day I wound up on the overnight on a horse. You know, they just said, it wasn't like I had really too much say. I knew I was getting close to ready. I was pretty close.
Yeah.
Getting ready to ride. But, I mean, you never know when you're ready until it happens, you know.
And do you remember your first race, Chris?
Yeah, she won. Her name was Romeo's Mistress.
Wow.
Not, on the slop, yeah.
Not too many people can say they won with their very first mount ever. And
yeah, I know.
Where was that at?
That was at Aqueduct.
Do you remember how the race went? Do you remember, was it tight? Was it close?
Yeah, it was in the slop. It was the first race. It was pouring. It was the day before the Derby. It was the day before Angel won on Spendabuck.
Wow.
So they were all nervous. And he was actually more nervous than I was. But, yeah, I remember she broke out of the gate. And they actually thought they were looking at the wrong horse. They thought I got left.
No.
But I didn't. And I remember being, I was in between horses, and then I made the lead around, I guess, the top of the stretch. And she wound up hanging on, winning by a nose.
Oh, wow.
Not by a nose, by about a half a length.
Okay. So you knew you won?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I knew I won.
I remember my first race, Chris. I won by a nose, and I didn't even know if I won. Did I win?
No,
did I win?
Yeah, right. Sometimes you think you win and you get beat, right?
Well, like, you don't want that to happen because that's not a very good feeling. Yeah. Did they get you good after the race, Chris? Did they initiate you?
Yeah, I got initiated.
Oh, yeah.
It took like 4 or 5 outs to get me, but yeah. Yeah, I was a little wiry kid. But, yeah, they got me.
They got you. And where did your career take you after that, from Aqueduct? Where did you go from there?
Well, I stayed in New York for a year. I won the Haskell in, I guess, the following January of 86. And then I came up here and I guess it was 3 days before the Traverse. I went to Monmouth to ride 2 horses for Alan Jerkins. And the first horse broke his leg, and I wound up breaking my finger, wrist. And that, you know, that knocked me out, and then the horse won the Traverse. So that was like kind of like a...
Oh, my God.
That was a bummer.
You just...
It was like a crossroads. Like, wow, what could have happened? But anyway, you know, and then from there, I went to Jersey the next year, and Jersey was I probably spent equal amount of time in both places, Jersey and New York, and then going to Florida in the winters.
Chris, you kind of, you went very fast over the fact that, you won the grade one Haskell when you were 17 years old. And, that's just incredible to me. And we got to talk about that. That's incredible. So tell me how a 17-year-old ends up winning the Haskell. How did you end up on Wise Times?
Well, Phil Gleaves was my agent was Ralph Thoreau Jr., and him and Phil were really good friends. And he came back from Florida. He had like 12 horses that he was bringing up from, I think he was in Canada. I guess he started in Canada, then he went to Florida, and he was coming back to New York for the summer. And, well, anyway, it was a week before the Haskell, and I'd been getting on horses for him, and I'd worked Wise Times 4 or 5 times. And he asked me if I would go down on a Friday to ride him. And I, you know, it was Twilight Racing in New York, so I wound up riding in New York. I rode the first 2 races, and then we drove down to Monmouth. Or my agent drove me down to Monmouth, and I rode Wise Times, and then he won. And then he got invited into the Haskell, and I kept him out.
That's incredible.
And the following week, he won.
Wow. Tell me about that race. Tell me about the Haskell.
Well, it downpoured like two races before. Speed had been holding all day. Nothing had been coming from off the pace. And then it rained. And then the first race after, the track became sloppy. The horse came from off the pace. Mm. And then the following race, the same thing happened. So I thought, well, now, you know, I have a chance. I mean, the horse was a long shot. He was 24-1, but at least my chances were a little better, being that it was sloppy and speed wasn't holding. So he broke out of the gate. He broke real sharp, and he was a closer. And they were rolling going into that first turn. I eased him back. I dropped him to the fence. And when I hit about the 5/8 pole, as in the race, like I did in the race before, I reached down and I hit him once just to get him on the bridle. Once I hit him, he got on the bridle, and then he just started taking me to holes instead of having me to ask him to go. Mm. And due to the fact that they were going so fast, a lot of them started coming back to me by the time I hit the half-mile pole. I was able to save ground around the turn, and Antley was on a horse, and he wound up stopping, and he kind of backed up into my face, but I was able to wheel out and go around him. And once I wheeled out and got around him, then I had, I believe it was Danzig Connection and Personal Flag, and or not Personal Flag, Broadbrush were in front of me. And I passed them at the 8th pole. And then I was just like, where's the wire? Where's the wire? Because I saw Personal Flag shadow coming, or I heard him coming. And the wire hit, and I was a length in front.
Wow. That had to be an incredible feeling. And right before the Haskell, you just lost your bug, too. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think it was my second mount without the bug.
Wow.
Second official mount without the bug.
That's incredible, Chris. And going into the race, were you confident? Did you think you had a shot? I mean, like you said, you were a long shot, and obviously you always have to have confidence when you get a leg up on a racehorse. But did you think you had a shot?
Yeah, you have to go into, you know, if positive, did I think I was going to win it? No, but I mean, I had just as good a chance as anybody else.
Right.
I mean, the favorites were obviously standouts. I mean, you had a Belmont winner, and then you had Broad Brush. He was just like a market consistency. My horse had won the Lexington and had been competing against them, but never with much success. You know, I think it was a combination. He liked the track. He loved the slop, and he got good at the right time.
And then you mentioned earlier, Chris, how the sport is full of highs and lows, and you experienced that for sure whenever you win the Haskell, and not much later you have an injury, which causes you to miss riding Wise Times in Travers. We all know jockeys' injuries are inevitable. They're going to happen. It's not if, it's when. But to miss out on something like that, that had to be really devastating. How do you deal with that? How do you mentally deal with that? That has to be so frustrating.
How did I deal with it? I probably cried. I think I did. I'm depressed.
Oh, my gosh.
You just have to, you know, at the time I was 17 years old, so you just got to put it behind you and, you know, move on, basically. You can't dwell on things that happened in the past.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise, you know, you don't get anywhere.
How long were you out for?
I was out till September 15th, I think, somewhere around there.
Goodness. Was that?
And then he came back. Then he came back and run in the Super Derby, but I didn't get the mount back on him because owner said I wasn't fit enough yet. So.
Oh my gosh. Duh,
yeah.
That would.
So I was 2-for-2 on him lifetime.
Oh my goodness! Did you get him back after that?
Nope.
No. Oh my gosh.
I think he
was
done after that.
Okay.
I don't even think he won another race after that.
But. Okay. Well. And because you weren't on him, they should have figured that out. Come on now.
Nah, I don't know. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's why. That's why I didn't win anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. So tell me I'm assuming that was your first real injury while you were riding races. And how was it coming back from an injury? How did you get fit again? Just galloping horses?
Yeah. They didn't have rehabs like you have now. I mean, it was my finger anyway, so it wasn't really too much rehabbing I could do. I had galloped horses for about maybe three or four weeks. You know, I was 17 years old. When you're a kid, you bounce back quicker than you do when you're older, obviously.
That's true. That's true.
And then I wasn't out too long. The first race, you know, the first couple of times I passed the 3/8 pole, it was like, you know, you didn't know if the horse was going to be, I didn't have confidence. I didn't know if the horse was going to fall or what, but you know, after you do it a couple of times, then it just becomes old hat again, old habit.
Forget about that again, right? Yeah. Moving on, like you said, moving on to the next one.
Yeah, you have to get through that. Otherwise, you know, you can't ride scared. You ride scared, you might as well quit.
No, that's absolutely true. And when you think about it, I mean, an ambulance follows us around. So it's hard for people to kind of grasp how you block it out of your mind, the fact that it's so dangerous. But
yeah.
How would you describe to our audience, Chris, how do you do that when you just get a leg up, you just focus on the race or how do you do that?
Riding so long, I'd never really gotten hurt, but you know, you fall off the horse, you get back on. And that's basically the mentality that I had. You know, you just have to overcome your fear. You can't think about it too much.
Yeah.
You know, if something's going to happen, it's going to happen. You can't control it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So
things you can't
control.
When
you start second guessing yourself, you know, that's when you put yourself in danger and you put other guys in danger behind you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's
because they don't know what you're thinking. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And like you said, when you start doing that and you're a little bit nervous up there, scared, it's not something you should be doing when you're riding like that.
Yeah.
Definitely not. But Chris, so you came back from your injury, not a bad injury, but it cost you a couple wins. But tell us where you went from there.
After that, I went to Jersey, and then after New Jersey ended, I went back into New York, and then Birmingham Turf Club, so we're opening up a racetrack in Alabama, because it was the first year they were running, and a guy took my book from Kentucky, wanted to go down there, so I went, and it was my first time actually leaving, like, home, like, leaving, like, far. You know, prior to that, I was in New York and New Jersey, and it wasn't really too much of a culture shock, but it was different. It was definitely different, but I did get to ride Lost Code.
And
I rode him in the race that he bled.
Oh no.
And then he won like five or four graded races afterwards. It was just bad, bad luck again.
Oh no. Well, we will talk more about Birmingham, Alabama after this short commercial break. Stay with us. While you're waiting, though, check out Sirius 145. Mike and Jude are live at Fasic Tipton tonight. You're listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
You can make money at the track this summer. Some of the best thoroughbred racing of the year is on tap at Saratoga, Del Mar, Arlington Park, Monmouth Park, and Woodbine, so the opportunities abound. With insightful handicapping, inside information, and worthwhile wagers at all your favorite resort tracks. Racing fans from coast to coast use PopeJude.com's reports every weekend as another set of eyes on the past performances to affirm their own choices or consider a horse they may have dismissed. You can make money at the track this summer. Go to PopeJude.com to learn more. That's PopeJude.com.
If it happens in horse racing, it happens on HRRN.
Nyquist and Exaggerator, they're coming to the line together, and Nyquist is still unbeaten. He has won the Kentucky Derby, but Exaggerator has turned the tables. He has won the Preakness Stakes. Destin and Creator, these two come down to the line together to close the goal.
Racing's biggest events are right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Join the Horse Racing Radio Network Friday, August 12th for our exclusive coverage of the 2016 Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Beginning at 10 a.m., our award-winning team will bring you live coverage as the Hall of Fame honors trainer Steve Asmussen, jockey Ramon Dominguez, horses Rachel Alexandra and Zenyatta, and more. The 2016 Hall of Fame induction ceremony, only on HRRN. Go to horseracingradio.net for more information or to listen live. You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Past the quarter pole in the Santa Ana. Her eminency is being challenged strongly now by Glory. Glory puts the head in front of her eminency, and Fresh Feline joining in, and so is Tutti Paese in the bright pink cap. Glory has a narrow lead past the eighth pole from Tutti Paese and Fresh Feline. Glory, the leader from Fresh Feline, Tutti Paese. Glory, Tutti Paese lifting late. And DiCarlo got the grey home of the last stride in the Santa Ana. Tutti Paese nailed Glory, Fresh Feline third.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm Christina McManigal, and I'm joined tonight by jockey Chris DiCarlo. We just heard the replay of the recent 2016 Santa Ana Stakes, the Grade 2 aboard Tutti Paese. Chris, we'll talk about that in a little bit, but before we went to the break, we were talking about when you went to ride in Birmingham, Alabama, and you mentioned you rode Lost Code, and let's take it from there.
Yeah, so I stayed there. I didn't stay the whole meet. I kind of got homesick. And after losing that mount, then I was like, really? I said, let me get out of here. You know, it was just a freak thing. I got thrown under the bus, but the horse bled. It was like nothing I had control of. Anyway, no. I went back to New York, and I was there till, I guess, after Saratoga again. And then I made the switch to go to Jersey full time. And then I rode in Jersey for 2 years. And then I went to Florida, and I did really good when I first got down there. And then Gulfstream came, and my business slowed down, and then it really slowed down once we went to Calder. I kind of got, I was fighting my weight and wasn't really happy riding. I was riding bad horses, so I stopped. And I went to work with my dad, who was a stockbroker. So I took the Series 7, and I did that for about, I passed the test, I did that for about 6 months. And then an opportunity came about for me to go to France. It was brought up by my mom. And I was like, yeah, right, if it happens, you know, I'll go. And thinking nothing would ever materialize. And then it did. And so I went to France, and I did really good when I went there. Well, I mean, I did good for what I rode. And after going back to riding, I realized, you know, this is what I was meant to do. I never really had any satisfaction of when I would sell somebody something, you know, like it was just I didn't feel like I earned it, you know, even though you do, it's more mentally than anything else. I didn't feel like I was really doing anything. And when I came back from France, I went back to New York and hung out there. I rode there for 4 years. And then in 2000, I went back to Monmouth, and Angel had hooked me up with Todd Pletcher, and, you know, he helped me from 2000 up until now. You know, he's a major part of my success.
Chris, we got to go back to the fact that you are a stockbroker. I find that fascinating. That is quite different from riding racehorses.
Yes.
That's kind of the polar opposite.
Oh, yeah. I had like problems with that. You know, being a jockey, you're your own boss and all that. And office life just wasn't meant for me. You know, it was like if I was programmed to do that, had I finished school and went to college and did that whole thing, no, I wouldn't have a problem with it. But being the fact that, you know, you're doing something you love, number one. Number two, you're confined to the inside. And, you know, you had all these rules. Well, you know, you have bosses. And I was like, I didn't like answering to anybody. Let's put it this way. Yeah. I mean, I answer to them now, you know, when I ride, but it's different. You know, it was just a different atmosphere.
Well, and you answer to the trainers, but at the same time, when you're out on the horse, you're in charge of the horse, or you like to think so anyway.
But whether you're right or wrong, I mean, you know, the goal, the bottom line is to win, you know, so we all have the same goal, you know, whether it happens how we want it to happen, you know, that doesn't always work out. Sometimes it does, but a lot of the times it doesn't. A lot of the times it's like, well,
and Chris, you missed it too much, so you had to go back in France. That is fascinating. And what was it like there?
Oh, it was totally different. It was just like, first off, it's a totally different language. So when you go to a place, and, you know, you don't know the language, and, you know, you see them looking at you and talking. It was intimidating, as I should say. But riding horses is riding horses, you know, so that was like the equalizer. Yeah, that was fun. I learned a lot, too. I learned a lot more horseman-wise as far as trusting the horses and what, you know. Even though I was only there 3 months.
And I would,
it's just amazing.
I would think you would learn. I'm sure there were full fields and turf racing, and they ride their riding styles completely different. That had to be an incredible experience to learn so much there.
Yeah, because some of the races they actually walk, and you know they all break. While they say it's not important over there, it's extremely important, because when you have 26 horses in a race and you're going a mile and 7/8 or a mile and, you know, however far they run, because they run longer distances, you really need position, because when they break out of there, they'll go to quarter in a canter. They'll go in 30. Yeah. And the difference between riding there and riding here is however they break, that's pretty much how they stay the whole entire race till the quarter pole. And then they'll split. So you can't make ground up in the middle of the race like you can here, because they ride so tight and everybody's like in a little ball.
Wow.
And, you know, you really have to learn to be patient and just wait and wait and wait. And the first time I was in the pack where I was like in the middle, I was like a little nerve wracking, because here I am thinking, all right, the guy in front of me, we were so tight. I was clipping the guy in front of me's heels. He was clipping heels. And then you got guys behind me or next to me right on top of me, and they're clipping heels. And I'm thinking, oh, man, is this how it's going to end? You know, am I going to walk? You know, it's just kind of scary. But once you do it a few times and you get in the pack, you have to learn to trust the horses. You know, you can't reach up and grab them, because if you do that, then you're going to, you know, you throw them off balance. So you just have to try to trust the horses and let them do their thing. Because, you know, when they're running in packs, you know, rarely will you see a horse fall. Now, I know we use shoes, and shoes, you know, with toe grabs, like on the dirt, that's more common because they're going to catch something that's going to make them trip. But on the grass, you're running in a flat shoe, so they slide off of it. So while you don't want to be riding right on top of heels, you know, you have to have enough trust in the horse that he's not going to fall.
That's a hard thing to do, and especially, as you mentioned, riding in a tight group like that, that makes me cringe a little bit when you mentioned hearing everyone clipping heels, and it was, oh gosh, I hate that sound.
Yeah, it's hard. It's like, oh my God. And like, you might run a mile like that, the first mile of a race like that, because they're just going so slow.
Wow.
You know, and it's like kind of like, geez, will you guys, someone please go already? This is like, not only are you making it easy for the guy in front, but I mean, come on, who wants to ride like this the whole way? You know, you want a little, relax a little bit.
I had to have ice in your veins. Boy, that's...
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Well, it was funny because one of the guys, he was an old jockey. His name was Guy Guignard. So I'm riding in the last race, and I come in and I check, and he hands me like a little, it was a beer. I'm like, what the heck are you doing this? Over there you can, I guess it's not shunned upon. They can have like a glass of wine or something. I don't think anybody's going to get drunk and bombed. You know, that would be, but you know, they do that over there, or they did at the time. And, you know, I didn't drink it. And obviously, you know, as the race was being run, I was thinking, man, maybe I should have drank it because it was scary. It was like 36 horses. And we were, like I said, and I was like maybe 18th or 19th. It was just like, I was trapped. I couldn't go anywhere.
That's why they drink. That's why they all
drink. Yeah, it relaxes them.
Wow. And how about the riding style over there? Did you have to adjust, or did you just, you did your thing and you let, you know, you watched everyone else do theirs?
No, well, the riding styles are completely different. I just, the only thing I changed was, instead of riding real AC-DC, I might have picked up my inside stirrup a couple holes. But, yeah, it was, I didn't really change too much. I mean, riding, going right-handed the first time was a little different because you're on your opposite leads. But after doing that a few times, it's normal.
Yeah, that would be weird.
You get used to it. Going up hills and down hills was a little bit, that was a little different. Because when you're going up a hill, you have to really keep them gathered because they use too much energy.
Mm.
Going down the hill, you would kind of just drop their heads and let them, you want to make the horse do it on their own, you know.
That's interesting. And you stayed there for 3 months, Chris?
Yes, I was there 3 months.
How about the weights? Were the weights heavier over there?
Yeah, which was good because like I was off for 2 years or year and a half. So the lightest I had to do was 122. So I think I was about 118 or 117 when I was riding there, when I first got there. And I really felt good. I mean, now I'm like 112 and I feel a lot better when I'm 117 compared to 112.
Yeah, yeah.
It's only 5 pounds, but 5 pounds on me, I could see it.
Yeah.
Or at the time, I felt a significant difference.
No, yeah. that's a huge difference for small people. You know, that's a really big. What do you think, now, Chris? What do you think about the current weights in the United States? Do you think that's something that should be raised? Do we need to, you know, look at those? I mean, everyone has different opinions on the weights here.
Well, I mean, if you raise the weights, it's great for the guys that are riding now. But what happens is you open the door for guys that are too big to ride at the current weight. And they're going to have to do the same things that we do now for the lightweights. So, I mean, is it really, should they raise them? I don't think it hurts a horse to carry 122. I mean, 124, they're a 1,000-pound animal.
Yeah.
You know, it's not really, you know, that big of a deal. I mean, I remember one race, I think I carried 136.
Wow.
You know, so the horses can carry it. Well, it's, you know, I've always tried to be light so it's not hard for me to do the weights now, you know. It depends. You know, some people say we should raise the weight. Some people say we should leave them the same. You know, I know people are growing in society. They're getting bigger, so they're probably going to have to raise the weight. So you don't see really too many American jockeys.
No, you don't.
You know, they're mainly Latin, and they're smaller people.
Right.
You know,
right.
As a society.
Well, you know, and it's a lot of, you know, like you said, just Americans are just getting bigger, you know. Maybe it's, I don't know, too many McDonald's. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what it is.
But like you said, I completely agree with you in the fact that I don't think it would really help anything other than the guys riding now who struggle making, you know, 116, 118, that's tough. But like you said, that's just going to open the door for bigger guys to try to be skinny. So
right.
It wouldn't really help anything, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the little guys will get healthier, but the bigger guys losing the weight, you know, they're the ones going to be getting
sick. Exactly. What's your regimen now? How do you keep your weight down?
Well, now I go to the gym like 3 days a week, and I just try to keep my metabolism up. And I would eat a lot of I eat a lot of protein. I try not to eat too much carbs if I can.
Yeah.
But
what do you
fruit
do?
And
what do you do at the gym?
I'll do cardio for about a half hour, and then I do weights. And I do whole body. It's not like I do legs one day. And I, you know, because riding horses, we're using all of our muscles. Well, not all of them. You know, because obviously I work out muscles in the gym that I don't riding, but we're using our whole body. So, you know, I think it's better to keep your body used to doing that, you know, being conditioned that way. It doesn't hurt me. It's not, you know, I don't feel the need to work on arms one day and legs one day. I treat them all the same because they're getting worked out anyway.
Right. Do you have to hit the hot box?
No, I try not to.
Yeah. I hate that place.
I'm a little claustrophobic, so like I hate going in there. I mean, if I have to, I will.
Yeah.
But I'm not really a good sweater.
Yeah.
So for me to like lose like 2 pounds, it takes an hour.
Wow.
Some people go in there like 20 minutes and they lose it.
Yeah. But yeah, that's... Oh, I always had more luck, you know, in the morning wearing a jacket when it's 80 degrees and then, you know, you're moving and, you know, you're not thinking about it versus just sitting there in the hot box. That's
a whole other thing. Like, I can't be like, I can't wear like a lot of clothes in the morning. I get claustrophobic. It's just like,
really?
Yeah. Like in the wintertime, like I'll wear, well, they say the less you wear in the wintertime when you run, the more your body burns calories because it's fighting to stay warm. So you lose more weight. So, and in the summertime, I just wear shorts, you know, I'm going to sweat or I'm going to sweat. I'm not going to, like I said, I don't sweat that good. And
yeah. Well, that's
putting all those clothes on me, it would drive me nuts.
Well, jockey Chris DiCarlo joining me on Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Chris, you are claustrophobic. That is interesting to learn. I did not know that. But you mentioned a little bit ago that Todd Pletcher has been so helpful. And I think back, that's actually where I first met you when I was working for Todd Galloping in the Mornings. And
right. You've
said several things during the show, how you don't talk a lot and you just observe. And I noticed that back in the day. You were always very, very quiet. Very, very quiet,
right.
but I always, you're so good on the horse. I have a picture, actually, of you and I working horses in company at Palm Meadows. I still have it, like I said, long time ago. But tell me how you got in with Todd Pletcher. Was that through Angel Cordero?
Yeah, he was definitely instrumental in that. And, you know, he sent me out of town a few times, and I got lucky. And then he decided to send a string down to Jersey. And, you know, he gave me a shot on some horses and got lucky again. And then finally got into the rotation for a while.
And do you still ship around for him a lot?
Yes, occasionally, when he asks.
Do you mind that moving, like, not moving, but traveling all over the place and jumping on planes?
No, I like it. Sometimes not making the flights being on time is stressful.
Yeah.
you know. But yeah, I like riding at different places. It's fun.
Yeah, the fights.
It's exciting. It's like an adrenaline rush.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. And you get to go and see so many different places and.
Well, it's not like you stay and can enjoy them. You know, you're there for one thing, to work and come back.
Sure.
But yeah, it's neat.
That's awesome.
I like it.
Now, Chris,
it's a perk.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, you get to see the sights. So, like you said, it's just for a brief time, but at least you get to see the racetracks anyway and the airport. Yeah. But, Chris, I was doing my research and found out something very, very interesting. And that in 2011, so you were in France before. Then in 2011, you traveled to Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
Tell me how that came about.
One of Todd's former assistants, Jonathan Thomas, I guess had been out there, a year prior, and they were looking for jockeys, and my name came up, and I got the opportunity to go over there and ride for the King.
Wow.
Yeah, that was neat. He had rocket ships.
Really?
I mean, he was like, well, it's a sport of kings, and my boss was a king. So he had to have the best horses, you know.
Makes sense.
It was like a win-win. It was a win-win situation.
Yeah, that does make sense, definitely. And now, did your whole family? You have kids, and did your whole family move with you?
Yeah, I went for the first month, and then my wife and my daughter came a month afterwards. My daughter was like 3. Yeah, she was 3 years old.
And what was?
And I thought it was cool because she would get this, not that she'll remember it, but I mean, she could say that she was in Saudi Arabia on the King's Farm when she was a kid.
Not very many people say that. What was the, so you lived there at his farm?
Yes, he had a big farm. It's like right behind the airport.
Wow.
Like literally right behind it. And the track is directly across the street from the farm. So, I mean, everything, for being in the middle of nowhere, everything was right there.
You know? Wow.
But the racing was neat. It was probably the best dirt surface I ever rode. It was sand, but you never had to pull a goggle down. And there was 18 horses in basically 90% of the races.
Wow. That's crazy. What was the riding style like over there? How were the other riders?
They were actually very straight. The stewards were very, very strict. A lot of the problems that you would run into there is because there's so many horses. Some of the horses are really bad, and when they stop, you know, if you're in a tight pack, that's just like mayhem because everybody's checking and, you know. So, the horses that I rode, I would basically leave there and let them run. And I knew they were superior horses, so I would always try to have my position going into the turn because I knew my horse at the quarter pole was going to take off where the other ones might, you know, they'd start passing out by the time they hit the half, and yeah, they didn't want to have to deal with all that traffic. And over there, it's a big track, and they didn't really shun upon losing ground. They didn't want your horse stopped. But, yeah, it was definitely neat. They rode good there. And the movies were different than they are here. Like over here, when you get disqualified, you know, you have whatever, 18 hours before, you know, you have movies the next day. Mm-hmm. Over there, you go into the room and you're standing in front of the three judges, and it's you and the other jockey, and they have like 3 screens behind you. And one of the screens was like a giant, looked like a movie theater screen, and they have a close-up of you. And you state your case, and the other guy states his case, and then you turn around and watch the films. Now, once the films are being watched, you can't speak. And then the stewards, you turn around, and then the stewards, you know, voice their opinion, and then you wait outside, and you find out if you get dazed or not right then and there.
Wow.
It's actually pretty good.
Yeah. That's cool, although I don't know if I would want to see a big, huge screen of myself behind me. But
oh, yeah, you can see, yeah, it's amazing. Amazing. And they had, like, 2 stewards were from England and 1 was from Saudi. So,
were they strict with their punishments? Was it, you know, typical, you know, you get 3-5 days here, there, or fines?
Yeah, no, they were very. No, they would fine you. One time, I picked up a horse, and every stable has their own colors. Well, I didn't have the color cap that they had, so I wound up picking up a horse. They asked me to ride the horse, and when I came back after the race, I had the wrong cap on, so they fined me.
No.
They fined me like $500. I was like, you got to be kidding me. You asked me to ride the horse because I don't have the cap and I don't ride for the guy. You're going to fine me?
What?
Yeah, but they would fine you. And then days, because they only run 2 days a week, you know, if you get 4 days, it's almost a month of racing. So, wow. I mean, is it strict like here? Probably is because they're not working as, you know, you're not working as much. You know, over here, you take 4 days. They're running. Well, in Saratoga, anyway, they're running 6 days a week. So, yeah, it's almost half the week you miss. It's not really that big of a punishment.
Right, right. So they run only 2 days a week. So what did you do the rest of the time? Sit by the pool? Did you have to work horses in the morning? Or
yeah, I would get on horses in the morning. And then we would take my wife into the city. The city was like a 45-minute drive. And It was different. It was definitely different for her. She had to wear the abaya and everything, but it does get a little boring. But you know, I had my 3-year-old daughter there,
yeah.
So I got to watch her, even though I was home and I wasn't riding a lot. I got to watch her grow up. You know, so that was fun. Actually,
that was definitely a perk of the experience for sure. So you said your wife had to wear a head covering when she went out?
No, not the head covering. It's like a black gown. It covers their clothing, what they wear underneath.
Okay.
Which is kind of odd because, you know, you go into the malls there and they have like all these high-end designer couture stores like Chanel. They had Jean Paul Gaultier. And I'm like, all right, these women, they spend all this money on these clothes and they can't wear them in public. It makes absolutely no sense. But when they have parties at home, they could take the abaya off and show off their clothing, or when they come to America, they could wear it, you know, so.
Ah, that is very strange. That is.
Yeah, it was like a little odd.
But. Yeah, definitely. And how long did you stay there, Chris?
I was there 6 months.
6 months. 6 months. Would you go back if you could?
I don't know about now.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if I went to ride for the King, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Because they feel a little bit more secure.
Right.
You know,
right.
I don't know. If someone asked me, I may say yes today and no tomorrow and yes, you know, I don't know.
So how you feel, right? Only Chris, his time has flown by. Only a couple of minutes left. Tell us what you're doing now.
I'm up here in Saratoga, and just working. Basically, this weekend I have to go to Arlington to ride Tutti Paesi in the Everly D. So,
Yeah.
Let's hope we have some luck there.
Fingers crossed. We will be cheering for you, Chris. And I actually just left Saratoga. I was up there for the Whitney. And gosh, I love it up there. That is definitely the place to be for the summer. Definitely.
For sure.
Oh, my gosh, I love it. And where will you go during the winter?
I'll probably stay at Aqueduct. And we'll see. There's a possibility I might go to Florida this winter. It's kind of up in the air. I ride a lot of grass horses, so the winter times in New York, you know, my business gets hurt. So, but I'm doing it to be close with my daughter, you know. So I don't want to move her around, and I don't want to be away. So, you know, I'll have to cross that bridge. I have to come up with a decision soon, though. But I don't know when.
You'll figure it out. You'll figure it out, Chris. Good luck next weekend, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, don't forget, Mike and Jude are on Sirius 145. They're live at Fasig Tipton Saratoga Sales. Switch over there now. If you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out our website, horseracingradio.net, and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Don't forget, we are now on Sirius 219 XM 206, where you will find us next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.